The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Alex Wagner is co-host of Showtime, previously hosted MSNBC's Emmy-nominated Now with Alex Wagner, among many other credits. In her debut book, Future Face, she describes immigration as an interior act, becoming something new, and as the social act of losing one home and making another. She combines memoir and journalism in order to trace the two halves of her upbringing and arrive at an understanding of where she came from and who she is. At a time when so much emphasis is placed on ethnic, religious, and national divisions, she constructs a narrative where we all belong. She'll be joined in conversation this evening with Tracy Matisak, award-winning broadcaster and journalist. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Alex Wagner and Tracy Matisak to the Free Library.
Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you, the city of brotherly love. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you, and your book was fascinating. It was an incredibly in-depth study of your family history. What was it that prompted you to do that research?
So I grew up thinking of myself as generically American. I liked Murder, She Wrote, and I liked Chips Ahoy, and I thought I looked and was considered the same way all of the other kids in my class were considered. And then there was this kind of eureka, rosebud moment when I was in a diner with my dad, and my father got up to use the restroom, and the line cook looked at me and said, "Are you adopted?" And it was, independent of being a really obnoxious question to ask a 12-year-old, it was also the first time where I thought, wow, wait a second, the way I see myself is not the same way that everybody else sees me. And the idea that I couldn't possibly be the natural-born daughter of a white American man made me think, well, what do people really think I am? And in my teens, I sort of began to sort of the inklings, the green shoots of sort of like the identity search started springing forth, and there was this cover of Time magazine in 1993 where there was a racial composite image of the future face of America, and I looked at it and I thought, that's me. I'm the future face of America, and that gave me a template from which to work, and I sort of like embrace this idea that I was this nebulous brown, Hapa mixed race avatar of the American future, which was exhilarating and fun up until a point, but that's also a fairly rootless way of going about life. And as I got older, I really craved a sense of belonging. And I think a lot of people, especially right now, are looking to find out where they belong and who their people are. And so the book was basically an exploration of trying to find my tribe, my people.
Yeah, and you certainly had some sense of family history from your mom and your grandmother. I mean, there were certainly relatives who could fill in some of the pieces of that for you.
Yeah, my mom was born in Rangoon, Burma, and my mom and grandmother both came to the United States in the mid-60s, and they would tell me these very wistful, kind of like dreamy reminiscences about Burma and what it was like to carry a palm frond as an umbrella when the monsoon rain arrives. It would be nice to have a palm frond right now in Philadelphia. And like, they were beautiful memories, but they never explained what happened, really. Why did we leave Burma? If Burma was so great, why didn't we just stay there? And there was never any deeper kind of sense of the things that broke, the things that pushed us out. Likewise, my father had this really perfect Rockwellian tableau of his life in Iowa, which was this he grew up in a tiny town on the Mississippi River, and he had this big Roman Catholic, Irish Catholic family, and his father was a rural mailman, and his mom was a stay-at-home mom who made donuts on Sunday and baked bread for the family, and they played stickball in the twilight hours of summer, and it was just kind of like, is this really real? Does this even really happen? But I accepted all of this, as many of us do. These were the narratives that I inherited. And up until the writing of this book, I kind of had never dug any deeper. I'd never thought, well, why did we end up in Iowa? And why did we leave Burma? And those were sort of two fundamental questions I set about to answer in the book.
So you did travel to Burma. And let me stop there, Alex, because you use the name Burma as opposed to Myanmar throughout
yes.
the book. Why
yes.
is that?
I feel like I'm ready to just like wave the white flag and call it Myanmar because I am always explaining this. And it is my last stand against what has been a very brutal military regime. And in the mid-1990s, they renamed the country Myanmar, which is the Burmese word for Burma, which is confusing. But basically, the British named the country Burma after the Bama ethnic minority. So while some people saw that move as kind of a nice sort of return to Burmese roots, other people who'd been witnessing the political situation over in Burma understood that to be a bid to deflect global attention from the human rights abuses that were occurring in the country. So as a form of defiance, many Burmese exiles and activists continued to call it Burma as a way of refusing to recognize the illegitimate military junta and its gross violations of human rights and human rights abuses. And I continue to call it Burma. And I still think that the political situation in Burma is abhorrent. And we can talk about Aung San Suu Kyi, who's the leader of the country, who's been, at best, a grave disappointment. Also because no Burmese ever say Myanmarese, which is what you'd have to say. It just does not roll off the tongue. But that's not real. I mean, the reasons are deeper and more, you know, well-founded than just what sounds good.
Yeah. Well, and I do want to come back to those things because they are important. I want to hear about your trip to Burma and what you discovered or did not discover. Certainly one of the things that struck you was that strain of nationalism, mm-hmm. if you will, that cast a long shadow over your mother's home country.
I traveled a lot for the book. I went to Rangoon, I went to Esch, Luxembourg, I went to London. These places are not close. Let me tell you, you cannot take a flight from Rangoon to Esch.
And that's where your father's family is.
And that's where my father's family is from, on his father's side. I went to Burma, and I had not understood, you know, I think in this present moment in America, we're very keenly aware of tribalism and nationalism and xenophobia. And it had never occurred to me that that might be part of my Burmese cultural inheritance. But the more I sort of dug into my family history, the more I realized that the sort of pro-democracy movement that Aung San Suu Kyi has come to represent very much dovetailed with a virulent, violent strain of nationalism that's been part of Burmese politics part of Burmese culture for the better part of a century. And indeed, some of that infected my own family. My grandmother harbored bigoted, racist attitudes towards Indian Muslims. And you see some of the harvest of that in today's ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya minority in Burma. It's a Muslim minority, many people say, is truly from India or Bangladesh, even though they've been in Burma since maybe even as early as 7 AD. But this notion that these outsiders were contaminating Burmese society, that's something that's a narrative that's been part of Burmese culture and was part of my family history. And I didn't realize that till I sort of started going deeper into the archives and also kind of fact-checking my grandmother's stories against historical record, which is not something we often do, right? But as part of the book, I did that. I also found out that my great-grandfather had a role to play in, like, the cratering of the Burmese economy, but that's not the question you asked. The point is, you know, I think the most important lesson from that was we all, first of all, nationalism and xenophobia is not unique to America. The mistake we make is thinking that it's isolated to certain groups of people and not trying to learn from history. I mean, the old adage that history keeps repeating itself is quite true. And especially when you look at family history, you realize how much bad decisions often keep coming up.
Yeah. What did you think when you came across this information and you saw this sort of threat of nationalism that extended even through your own family? Mm-hmm. What was your reaction to that?
I think, you know, it's hard to... I love my family a lot. And throughout this, you know, talking about the book, people have said, dear, is your family still talking to you? And my family is absolutely still talking to me. And I'm blessed to have a very, you know, interesting, forgiving, self-reflective group of people in my family. But it is hard to approach your family members with something revelatory like racism or like major career missteps that had repercussions across a society and to own that. But that's kind of the work of this moment, I think, is trying to own past failures, and trying to understand how they inform our thinking today. I mean, I think that's actually how we make progress and how we weave a tighter fabric of democracy and really American culture. So as hard as some of those conversations have been, and as much as my mom and I have had arguments repeatedly about the way she has been characterized in the book, I'm here to tell you she objects to some of them. You know, it's been good. I mean, and this is, like I said, I think this is kind of like the work of now, is looking at the ugly stuff and dissecting it and figuring out a way to like get past it in a way that's honest.
And there were things that you wanted to observe but really couldn't, because there was this sense of erasing of history to mm-hmm. some degree that I was really struck by as I read the book, that certain things were literally painted over yeah. or cemented over, but that the history was not preserved.
Yeah, so it cuts both ways, right? On one hand, Burma, and I don't know if anybody in the audience has been there, but the narrative, right on, the narrative that is, I mean, the metaphor that I use, and it's really, this is through my mother's eyes, because I remember going back with her for the first time, it's like a sunken ship. You can still see the outline of the hull and where the masts of the sails used to be, but it's all covered in barnacles and there's starfish living in the captain's galley. And I think there's like almost, I mean, as heartbreaking as that was, there's also a certain luxury of decay. Like, to go back and see the places that had just kind of, it was as if it was a land that time forgot. There was something, you know, almost affirming about that. Like, we left and then the whole country fell apart. Like, it's gone. It's all, you know, and you could see it's like being an archaeologist, right? It's heartbreaking, but it's also in a weird way validating. And then there were a few places where we went where places my grandmother had gone to school. And the government had rehabilitated them. And there was, you know, as you said, they'd been whitewashed. There was new cement. A lot of the reconstruction was slapdash. But it was kind of like, well, how dare this happen? You know, it's supposed to look the way it would have, you know, 50 years ago. And it should be rotting. It should be calcified. It, you know, because it placed us outside of the present day. You know, that Burma was no longer ours. And I felt really selfish at one point. I was with my cousin Jeff, and we were like, well, shit, it's like all new, you know? But of course, you know, in the best case, countries move on, right? So, like, it cuts both ways insofar as it's sad to see things really broken down, and it's sad in another way to see them repaired.
Well, sure, because you wanted to feel that connection, yeah. to stand in the same place where yes. your grandmother stood, and yes. to eyeball the same, you know, buildings and things like
right.
that.
Right, it's that whole, our ancestral heritage yeah. tour, right? Like, you want to go to Galway and, like, have a pint where your ancestors once trod, and you want to go to, I mean, you're going to go to Ghana, and you want to feel the vibrations of that moment when a whole, like, a continent was stolen and plundered. And that's a really powerful magnet, right? This frisson, this electrifying feeling that you're supposed to get from going back to the ancestral homeland. And it's very much adulterated when the homeland has been so changed.
Yeah. Before we move on to your father, I do want to circle back to Aung San Suu Kyi.
Sure.
Because you mentioned being very much of a disappointment. Remind us a little bit about the situation there with the Rohingya Muslims and her response to all of that and sort yeah. of where things are with that.
So I had like Aung San Suu Kyi keychains and T-shirts growing up. I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post 2 weeks ago. Burma, it was so hard to know Burma. Burma existed in like a black hole for people who, like me, who were born here and who didn't have much of a concrete relationship to the country. Aung San Suu Kyi was our porthole to Burma. She was the thing that we could all believe in. She helped us create an identity out of a vacuum. And there was so much hope and expectation when she was finally freed from house arrest. And I actually remember interviewing her in one of her first stateside interviews in 2014. And by then, the Rohingya were already notoriously persecuted, landless, stateless minorities so many calamities had befallen that. They were persecuted. And Aung San Suu Kyi was asked, well, what about the persecution of the Rohingya? This is like right after she's gotten out of house arrest. She said, let's be careful about the way we describe them. They're not persecuted. And I remember thinking, like, wait a second. That's not what you're supposed to say. And that's what no one's supposed to say that. Least of all you. You're the freedom fighter. You're the champion for democracy and equality. And I had never actually bothered to look deeper into, you know, her father's politics were very, very nationalist politics. He helped free Burma from the British, but also harbored a lot of anti-Muslim writings. And she herself has clearly harbors some of those same sentiments, because as the military government that she is sort of, as a government, which she is half a part of, has pushed these Rohingya out. I think 800,000 of them have fled the country. Untold tens of thousands of them have been slaughtered in the most just brutal way is possible. She has sat idly by. She has questioned whether or not it's fake news that they've been killed and persecuted and pushed out of the country. And she's been very resistant to news coverage. She has sanctioned effectively the jailing of reporters who have covered this genocide. The litany of sins goes on and on. And what I can only say as someone who had tied her sense of sort of Burmese-ness to this woman and her struggle, it has been so, I almost feel bereaved about it. You know, like it's so sad that this person who was our Nelson Mandela has acted so shamefully. Mm. And in a way where you can't ever put it back together again. There's literally nothing short of, like, I don't know what she could do to ever sort of get the esteem of the international community back, to say nothing of, like, what should be done with her Nobel Peace Prize. But you know, in the context of identity, it has shattered the stained glass window in many respects. But it has also been a learning experience, you know? I mean, I think this is the danger of having very surface heroes who were sort of like crafted out of simplistic narratives, and leaders of whom we don't ask tough questions, or people we don't educate ourselves about, who exist as kind of like glowing champions, but not real people. And, you know, I take a little bit of the blame here, because it's like I never bothered to know what her politics were. And in 2014, which was 8 years ago, when she said, let's be very clear that they're not persecuted, that should have just been like, you know, an alarm bell. Yeah. But it took until this point to find that out.
Yeah. Want to move on and talk about your father. As you researched his family, you came across what you refer to as the white immigrant origin story.
Yes.
What is
Don't
that?
We all have one? The white immigrant origin story, which is very popular at this particular moment in politics, is we white immigrants came to America and we pulled ourselves up by the bootstraps, and by divine providence and hard work, we made it here. And isn't it great? And wasn't America great then, and shouldn't we make it so again? And look, that is not to denigrate the hard work of white immigrants or brown immigrants, immigrants all over the place. We are a nation of immigrants. But it is a simplistic narrative, and it was very much my father's narrative. And I literally never questioned it until, and I feel, again, sort of silly saying that it took this book to get me to this place. But I had no idea why we were in Lansing, Iowa, why the Wagners picked this tiny plot of northeastern Iowa near the Mississippi River to call their own. So I started doing research. And I realized we got that land because we had kicked off, not we the Wagners, but we the U.S. government had kicked off, decimated, and killed off the native people who were there literally like 5 to 10 years before my great-grandfather got there, right? And it had never, I mean, of course I knew the story of the native people in this country, but it had never occurred to me that it dovetailed so directly with my own family story and or the white immigrant origin story, which is, of course, tied to, I mean, whiteness in America as brownness. Whiteness in America is tied to brownness in America 9 times out of 10. We just often don't see how they're tied together. And I think the revelatory moment came after I sort of understood that fact and understood the history of the land on which, you know, we had grown our vegetables and from which my grandmother had cooked. I just had a son at the end of writing this book, and I thought, you know what? When I tell him the story of his grandfather and the Wagners, I'm going to begin it at a different place. And it's going to begin a few years before the Wagners got there, and he's going to have a full accounting of how we got to that place, why it was ours, what was given to us, what we took as a country, as a people, and what is owed. And that's not to denigrate like the great things that my family did, but it's, I think, a more honest way of accounting like how we got to be great and big and strong.
Well, because the story you got was, well, they were just giving away the
land.
They
just gave away the land. Well, the reason they could give away the land was because they took it from someone else.
Yeah. I was struck, Alex, by one particular story that you told in the book about you, an experience that you had with your mom, and I want to say your grandmother, and was it your mother's husband in Alsace-Lorraine?
Yeah.
You walked into a restaurant. I want you to tell that story because I was struck by how that experience affected you and what you learned from it.
Yeah, we were in Alsace-Lorraine. I mean, I think, so there's, being a person, I mean, first of all, I'll just say, being a Hapa mixed race person, like I didn't identify, I think I more identified probably with white culture growing up because I was surrounded by white people and I work in American media, which is dominated by white people. And it's only like in my like my middle ages, it's only as I've gotten older that I think everyone is more acutely aware of race in this country, especially right now and especially honestly in the last decade. That I've really begun to grapple with being a person of color, right? Like, and then the fact that I am seen in many people's eyes, most people's eyes, as a person of color. I was in Alsace-Lorraine with my mother and my grandmother, both Burmese, and my stepfather, who is Dutch. And we were on a road trip, don't ask why. And we stopped for dinner in Alsace-Lorraine. Which is an interesting part of France with a lot of German culture. And we stopped in this very stuffy 4-star, 5-star, whatever, Michelin-starred restaurant. And I remember this kind of like, it was like a collective sneer descending on the room. And when my mom and my grandmother and I walked in, and I remember thinking like, these people don't, if I'm being generous, don't know what to make of us. And if I'm being not as generous, like these people don't like having 3 Burmese queens in their restaurant. And as kind of unappetizing as that feeling was, what was also true is that I remember feeling in that moment very self-conscious and in some ways almost ashamed. Like, oh, well, if I was just with my stepfather, I could blend in easier, you know? And there is nothing like that guilt when you're like, I know how I'm supposed to feel, which is defiant and proud, but I know how I actually feel, which is like, oh, I wish I could somehow minimize my brownness. And that's, you know, it was actually hard to write that part of the book because nobody wants to say that, right? Everyone wants to be like proud, like, fuck you guys. Sorry, I'm not allowed to use that language in the library, but you know what I mean? And I remember just feeling like, okay, this is real. And this is part of like the burden and the work.
Yeah. Well, and that was my question was, what did that teach you about what it is to be a person of color?
Yeah.
Not just in America, but as a citizen of the world.
I mean, I think there are tough choices that you're asked to make. And I think often we want to exist, especially mixed race people want to exist in both worlds. But we are often asked to choose between 2 binaries. You're either white or you're brown. And it's hard to be both. And that anecdote in many ways throws that into sharp relief.
Yeah. So you took a bunch of ancestry tests
Yes.
as well.
Is anybody after out
all
there
your...
taking DNA tests? Okay, look out. Look out for those DNA tests. Some of them are better than others.
So you found. And you also had several of your family members.
Yeah. I blanketed the labs with our spit. I spent a lot of money on DNA tests. Which is why I can't give away the books for free tonight as much as I would like. The fact of the matter is these tests are market driven, right? So Some of them purchase DNA, some of them acquire publicly sourced DNA, some of them are working to capture reference DNA from other parts of the globe on their own. It's a complicated process, but they use what's called reference DNA to compare what you give them. So they'll compare the spit or the DNA of a kind of unique population and use indicators in that to tell you what you are, right? It's a semi-complicated process, but the long and short of it is it's driven by market demand. So if there are a lot of Irish Americans taking the test, they're gonna make sure they got a lot of good Irish DNA on hand in their reference DNA. Which means you can probably get some pretty good results if you're an Irish American person taking the test. But, you know, there are not a lot of Burmese people taking the test, in part because the tests are $100. There are not a lot of people. Burma is not a wealthy country. Burma has basically been in an internet blackout for, it's like 5% internet penetration. It's not easy to upload like DNA tests to the internet or get your results from the internet, from Burma. And so as a result, like the test results that I was getting were all over the place for my mother's side. And even for my father's side, you know, one test told me I was 14% Scandinavian. Another test said I was 0% Scandinavian. And as I dug deeper into this, I talked to some of the scientists at each of these companies and they said, well, you know, it could be Scandinavian DNA that landed in Ireland, which is why it's showing up in your test. But that begot all these other questions. Like, when you say Scandinavian DNA, like, what are you talking about? Are you talking about the Vikings that landed in Ireland hundreds of years ago? Because we think of ourselves as Irish, but I guess we could be Scandinavian. The tests are, every year that goes by, the data gets a little bit better and the user interface gets a little bit more honest. But I started taking them in 2015, and I cannot tell you, things were all over the place with these tests. Some of them said my mom was Mongolian. My mom's not Mongolian. And then one of the scientists said, well, you know, it's kind of hard to get DNA out of China, so sometimes people, the tests correct to whatever the nearest country is where you can get DNA samples from. You know, there's the question of like, well, let's just assume we're all talking, you have Burmese DNA. What is Burmese DNA? Because Burma is a polyglot country. It was the Pew of Yunnan came down at the turn of the millennium. Was Burmese DNA pure before that or after that? Like, what are we talking about in terms of socio-cultural, political, historical boundaries when we talk about where this DNA is from and when it's from? There are a host of questions, and then there's the fun... I'm going off on such a long answer. But then there's this fundamental question of, like, is this really like bringing us all closer together? Because that's what these tests promote. The ads are like, there are people that look like me being like, I am now a citizen of the world. And like, maybe that's what everybody comes away with. But I noticed that when I took them and when other people that I knew took them, we'd find one piece of this DNA test that was like really interesting. And we'd talk about it at like cocktail parties, like, I'm 14% Scandinavian. That's why I'm so tall. You know, like you'd find these like curious little things. And it wasn't about like, hey, I'm a citizen of the world, brother, sister, let's hold hands. It was more like, what makes me different and special? Like, everybody wants like a fascinating, like unknown secret story about their family history. And that's what those DNA tests provide. They are not like an accounting of the truth. You don't find out that your parents, great-great-grandparents were slave owners, or you don't find out about the Winnebago. You don't find out about, you know, bad, like questionable decisions that your family made. You don't learn about your family history. You spit into a vial and you get told something exciting, some fractional racial percentage that like makes you different than everybody else. And I think if we're being honest with ourselves, that's what those DNA tests do. And at this moment when we are so separated from each other and so convinced of our own uniqueness, I don't know if they're like the best form of recreational pastime.
Yeah, so was it worth it in the end?
I mean, I'm glad I learned about, first of all, I'm glad I like brushed up on biology. You know, I was like, 23 chromosomes, what, DNA helix? I learned a lot about the science. Yeah. And I feel like I proselytize about this a lot because they're so popular. It's a $1 billion industry. And I think it's a little bit disingenuous the way that they're sold. And I think it's important to look at these things from a broader anthropological, almost evolutionary perspective. Every evolutionary biologist I talk to is like, this idea that we're scientifically racially different from one another, we're so similar. we are so similar. And this kind of doubles down on this idea that we are fundamentally, scientifically different from one another. When in reality, like, we're identical, basically.
Yeah. You mentioned your son a few moments ago. A couple questions around that. One is that if some future great-great-grandchild wants to go on a similar search, and certainly it will be easier to document given the times that we live in and social media and so forth, but what would you want that distant relative to discover about you someday many years hence?
Oh, she worked so hard, and she was such a good person. what would I want? You know, I would kind of like my great-great-great-great-great-grandchild, children, to be like, God, you know, Alex Wagner was no bullshit. You know, she was tough, but she was fair. She had a sense of humor, and she was kind. You know, those are like, that's like sort of like, what do I want to be when I grow up? But those are, you know, I think a sense of empathy and honesty, it's like really all I can ask for myself and for like the child that I'm raising, you know. Who knows what he'll do, but I just want him to be a person that's generous in spirit and sort of rigorous in thought. Yeah. So that's what I'm trying to do with my own life, I guess.
Yeah, and you mentioned specifically, you know, your father's story and maybe starting it at a different place. What else are you doing with your son now to help him understand his family history?
Well, he's like 10 months old, so right now we're working on walking.
First things
first. Keeping food in his mouth. It's a low bar, Tracy. But, you know, like little things, like we have a cat. Well, no, I'm trying to get like the cat and the child to play, not even play, just to have a peaceable arrangement. And I'm trying to use the word gentle a lot, just to kind of like, because I think that's like a good idea for him to be gentle. My husband's like, we don't want him to be too gentle. But like, you know, like I would like to cultivate an instinct of like curiosity and you know, kind of like observance, you know, to not always be like, I mean, my husband would be like, you're the most aggressive person in our family. So like, what are you talking about? But, and then this is so dumb. I'm sure if there's any, I mean, everybody here is probably familiar with children or has their own. He has these block sets and he's always knocking them down. And I'm constantly like, let's try building them back up. Like, I understand the impulse to knock everything down and like, that's cool. But it's also about building things back up. Let's be productive as we are destructive.
Good life lesson.
It's like
in that,
real,
right?
real basic stuff. But I hope that it, you know, makes an impression.
Yeah. And then, you know, not taking things at face value maybe as he gets older, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Well, to question things. I mean, I think it, like, so the book, it's good to question and it's good to be hard-nosed in your research. But it is also, and this is like why, I mean, this is my outlook on life, to be empathetic too, right? To not punish people for their sins, but to try and understand and help, like, move the ball forward.
You talk in the book about the sense of existential loneliness that you felt, that was a lot of, you know, what fueled your search to begin with. And I wonder, Alex, after all of the travel and the spitting and all of those things, what did you conclude from that? What did you learn about who you are?
So one thing is for certain about America in this present moment. We are very intrigued and obsessed with the past and the future. But we are not, I think, nearly invested enough in the present. And I myself was really obsessed with the future and the past doing the research for this book. But I came away from this thinking, you know, we Americans, we Homo sapiens, are destined to intermarry and trade and bring this world even closer together. And we are given, I mean, that's actually our destiny, right? I kind of like that I'm quite certain about as far as the future, as long as this planet is in orbit. But we are given a really limited time to sort of traverse this thin part of the Earth's crust. And our community, our people, my community is you guys. My community is my friends. My community is the people that I work with. My community is the people I talk to as a journalist. This is our time. This is our time on planet Earth. Yeah. And there was something deeply reassuring about that, but also super urgent. You know, like, we have no idea how long we get, and, like, time to double down.
Before we get to our audience Q&A, I'm wondering if one of you might loan me your book for a moment, because, Alex, if you're willing, I'd love to have you read just a short
passage. Oh, I didn't bring a copy of the book.
Mine is backstage, but might we borrow someone's
book? Does anyone have a copy of the book? Oh, this is so great. Thank you.
So there are some really just beautiful passages in the book, and there was one in particular that I would just love to hear in your own voice, if we might.
Sure.
Let me find.
There's also an audiobook that I read that's available for sale if you like what you hear on stage.
Let's see. What if we started maybe right about here and go to the end of the next page?
Okay.
And you can give us a little bit of context if you like.
So this is the beginning of the book where I am sort of deciding to embark on this harebrained voyage, detective work, ancestor quest, debunking of the Jewish theory, whatever you want to call it. And this is kind of the revelation that I have that, like, the work begins at home with my family. That's how I'm going to find my true community. After so much time, so many years spent looking outward to answer this question, I wondered if what I was looking for wasn't with me already, if instead of trying to be the lonely avatar of the mixed race utopia to come, I could go back. I could search my own blood to find my people in the here and now. Was there some part of my story in its improbable combination of DNA double helixes and far-flung genetics that might offer connection to that elusive camaraderie supernova for which I'd been searching? One's personal story is constant and irreversible, after all, something that will be with all of us from the next lunch hour until the last glimmers of light pass over our eyelids. If you could find a way to carry it, and all the people from it, then you'd never really be alone again. I began contemplating this and how I'd go about it. I'd never dug into the family archives with any degree of rigor or interest, if I was being honest, and knew so little about, well, everything that had come before my parents and me, the prehistories that ultimately determined my own story. I was going to have to learn. I was going to have to get serious about the past. I began to steel myself. And then, just as I was beginning my search, edging into the darkness of the family past, something impossibly serendipitous occurred, an event that snapped me once and for all out of my future-faced fantasies and offered this curious loner something impossibly seductive. A family mystery. It was a lifeline to another way of being, a hidden tribe of elders who might claim me as their own, and more urgently perhaps, whom I might claim as my own, a chance at long last to know myself and where I truly, really, for real this time, belonged.
Beautiful. Thank you. So we won't give away the mystery because they have to read the book for that.
Yeah, it's
but
a
it
deep
does
tease, as they say in the industry. Yes, deep tease.
It runs throughout. So let's take some time for your questions for Alex. We've got some staff members who have microphones, so just raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. Yes, sir.
Hi. Thank you. A two-part question. I really admired the work you did on MSNBC,
thank you.
I wanted to ask if you could. Just give us a bit of your background. You were an executive director of a nonprofit prior to that?
For a few years, yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to ask if you could sort of explain that transition, and then now that you're on CBS.
And Showtime, for all you political junkies, you should be watching The Circus, because it's amazing!
You know, if you could fill some of those blanks in, I'd appreciate that.
Like, you're asking the same thing my mom's been asking, like, well, how did this all happen? To be honest, and I was very happy to have the experience running the nonprofit that was started by a bunch of very wonderful and popular Hollywood folks, I've always wanted to be a journalist. And I think my desire to do that work was fundamentally about understanding the stories of persecuted people. But I was an editor at my elementary school newspaper. I was editor at the College Hill Independent outside of Brown, where I went to college. I was an editor at the Real Deal Junior High School newspaper. I was in magazine journalism for a while. And there was a moment, actually, it was Burma that was the catalyst for me doing the nonprofit work. I was working for a music magazine, and the Saffron Revolution, the march of all these monks, I don't know if you guys remember, but like thousands of monks were marching in Burma. And I remember watching this unfold on CNN, and I thought, what the fuck am I doing here? Like, the world, you know, Burma, this place that is where I easily could have been born. I know nothing about it. I've never been there. The issues facing the people of the world, my family, I still have family in Burma, are so urgent. I need to understand what's happening. And that was the moment I decided, like, I want to get engaged more directly with world affairs, world politics, international affairs. And through various circuitous paths, I was led to George Clooney, who is very active on combating genocide. And he was looking for someone who understood sort of media and also narrative and had an interest in global affairs. And I had worked for a stint at the Center for American Progress, which is a progressive think tank in Washington. And we talked, and it was a very good meeting, as all meetings with George Clooney are. My mom's like, you just wanted to work for George Clooney. No, I mean, I did just want to work for George Clooney, but I really, the reason I did it was because the work was really important. And we did great work in Zimbabwe and some work in Burma and, of course, a lot of work in Darfur and Sudan. And then I started writing about politics and contributing to AOL. And I knew one of the editors at Politics Daily, and after a couple of years doing the advocacy work, I really missed writing. And she asked me to come to Washington and cover the White House. And I did. And then from there, I was covering the White House for Politics Daily. And then eventually that got purchased by the Huffington Post. And I started doing, you know, like they would ask me to get my friend Chris Hayes, who I went to college with, was guest hosting. You guys were like, Chris Hayes. But Chris was guest hosting for I can't remember what show, but he asked me to come on as a guest because he knew that I was in Washington reporting. And then I started going on regularly. Then I started doing Keith Olbermann's show. And then they hired me to be a contributor. And then they gave me a show, which was like an insane idea. And we had that show for 4.5 years, which was a long time to be doing a daily cable show. But it was very, I have much love for my MSNBC family. And now I am working as a contributing editor at The Atlantic, which is my really, like, a most wonderful group of people ever. You guys should all read that website if you don't already, and the magazine, and listen to the podcast that I co-host. And I am a correspondent with CBS, and I'm a co-host and executive producer of The Circus on Showtime with John Heilman and Mark McKinnon, which is a weekly political documentary. And I wrote a book. That's how it all happened, sir. And I have a 10-month-old who I barely see. Truth be told, I'm like, who is this baby? I would not be able to do any of this without an incredible husband who is like the light of my life and who also released a book the same day I did, but is much, much, is a much better parent than I am right now. I'm going to make it up this summer.
Hi. So first I wanted to tell you that I'm 95.5% Ashkenazi Jew, so I'm very purebred.
I'm so jealous.
I'm very purebred, but I'm also 0.3% North African / Middle Eastern.
Exactly.
So that's why I tan in the summer. But no, it's so true. That was like my entire narrative of 23andMe. I was like, she's really on to something here.
This is right. You're like 0.3. By the way, like 0.3% is so
narrow.
It's
a statistical error.
By the way, we're all North African. Like, we're all African, BTW.
My entire family goes through and we're like, what's your, like, other 3%, 4%? Or like,
totally.
Like, my brother's more Jewish than both my parents. You're like, oh, was that such a mitzvah that you created a more Jewish child than you yourself? I mean, it's hilarious. So my actual question, you know, I think... I'm not going to probably travel back to like the pogrom days of like Russia and like Siberia. But how do you, like, journalism 101, talk to your family and get those sort of not whitewashed, like, rosy stories? How do you get some of that color just like within your family? How do you ask those questions? Because I was also really struck, you know, by just recounting history, and even now going to like museums and thinking about like the slave trade, like Christopher Columbus, you're like, I think they really taught that wrong in school. Like I can't unlearn that from when I was 10, but now I see it all so clearly, and it's like, it's wrong. And so, you know, how do you go about in your own life, and even like, you know, uncles, aunts, parents, siblings, just like your own community, and learn some of like those real stories and ask good questions about it?
What I realized, that's a great question. What I realized is that we often are just receptacles for family stories. We rarely ask our parents or our grandparents specific questions. We let them say, this reminds me of the time, right? But what I did is I went systematically to each one of my family members and I interviewed them, basically, which, by the way, everyone should do anyway because, like, you know, we all have limited time on the earth. And I would ask them, you know, specific questions and then follow-up questions. Like, well, what do you mean? What did that actually mean? And then I did something which most people don't do, which was I went to the library, I went online, and I thought, you know, like, what exactly was the credit crisis? And, like, these, like, vague economic terms would be sort of bounced around in the context of, like, celebrating our amazing legacy. And then I did some research, and it was like, wait a second, this is what was really happening. And this is actually the best part of genealogy, to your point about Christopher Columbus, is when you research your own family history, the great movements of history inevitably intersect with your own private stories, right? Like, I'd never thought about the Suez Canal, ever. I mean, I knew what it was. But the opening up of the Suez Canal opened up the markets of Northern Europe to Burma. And so the Burmese started growing under British rule rice, and Burma became the rice bowl of Asia. And I knew my great-grandfather was involved in the economy around that booming trade. That was all interlinked to this slice of the Suez Canal opening up and Europe becoming a viable place to do trade. It's one of the most exhilarating parts of genealogical research is, like, no family history exists, you know, in a vacuum. It intersects with, like, the Franco-Prussian War, the Suez Canal, the genocide of the native people, and it brings that history to life and it brings it home in a way that, like, no museum exhibit ever would. It's a very good exercise. Even if you do it just with your mom and your dad and say, like, or your grandparents, everyone should do it and videotape it, because that's the other thing. It's like technology really can embed some beautiful archival material that you will be glad you have in 20 years from now.
So the political side of immigration, which, you know, when you go to countries in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, you think, okay, we're in a single culture place. You come here and you go, it's kind of boring, but on the other hand, it's really exciting because we are every kind of person there is. What does it take, do you think, to get Republicans to back off of seeing everybody as the enemy?
Well, okay, first off, I'm just going to say, like, our demographic destiny is pretty clear. Like, this we're heading in one direction. And I do think that some of this is, I mean, there was this piece in the New York Times about this study that just came out. Like, the motivating thing is this fear of losing, of losing and then losing one's own cultural history and to, like, this nebulous brown future or unseen, unshaped future. And that has been coupled with, I think, a dishonest economic narrative about, like, immigrants taking jobs and so forth, right? That's tough to unwind. And we also have a president who is distinctly unapologetic. And I will tell you, I was in Indiana last week for the circus, and I was talking to Trump supporters, and they are as ardent as ever. And by the way, every Democrat who thinks, like, it's a foregone conclusion that the House and Senate are coming back to the blue side of the aisle, like, be cautious in that assessment. There is, you know, they have felt economic... Trump sort of rode into office on a message of economic anxiety, and he is taking credit for the unemployment rate being below 4%, the tax cuts, which, you know, sound good even if you're not necessarily benefiting from them. The people that voted for him feel very good about the promises that have been kept by this president. I think it's going to be hard for the Republican Party to unwind a narrative that has proven incredibly compelling and intoxicating to the base and is driving, like, I mean, support like I've never seen. I mean, this is more than, this is like a flourishing of an ideology that's, it's kind of like hard to imagine how it goes back into the box, per se, in the next 4 years. But I will say this, and I've said this throughout this book tour, I do think this is, I think this is more the end of a chapter than it is the beginning of something, right? Like, and I don't think that the chapter's only, like, two or three years. It could be eight, right? to be 10. But I don't, I know that's not what a lot of people want to hear. But, you know, like, I don't think America in 2040 is going to, I don't think we're going to be looking at the situation the way we necessarily are today. I could be wrong. Hopefully I will be alive then to either eat my words or, like, you know, flex my muscles. But it's going to be a while.
I was in Burma this
Thank you for visiting.
And I was so struck by the force of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't mention anything about that in the talk, so I was wondering how that affected you.
Yeah, Burma is, I think it's 90-some percent Buddhist. And that actually is part of the tensions that are erupting with the Muslim minority, is there the Buddhism is dovetailed with nationalism in Burma, and there's like an absolute, almost like zero, well, for Muslims especially. It's an interesting strain of Buddhism in Burma. It's Theravada Buddhism, and it's very animistic, very superstitious. It's unlike when I think Westerners think of Buddhism, they have a different, like, kind of Zen Buddhist idea, the idea of Zen Buddhism. This is a very, it's almost like, there's almost like voodoo aspects to Burmese Buddhism. I know this from growing up with my mother and grandmother, who is a devout Buddhist. The thing about Burmese Buddhism that most hung with me after I visited Burma was, you know, we went to Bagan. Did you go there? It's like this magical place where there are all these old stupas and Buddhist shrines that are hundreds of years old. Some of them have been really badly repaired, really just shitty, like, brickwork jobs. And it was really, I was really depressed by that, right? Like, they'd taken these amazing, what could have been a UNESCO heritage site, and they've, like, destroyed it by doing this really bad reconstructive work. And then I was, like, in the room where Aung San was assassinated. I got special access to it. And they had done the similar, like, crazy, shoddy treatment, like linoleum on the floor, like, just corny, like, light displays. And I was complaining about all of this to my cousin, and he said, you know, that's such an Occidental way of looking at things, Alex. You know, the Buddhists don't believe in, like, you know, it's all about, like, you accrue merits by building monastery shrines in this lifetime. It's not about focusing on the past. We're moving forward, getting reincarnated, and it's all a progress towards nirvana. But they don't hang on to the past in the same way that I think we do, right? Like, there's this sense of renewal and a cyclical, like, nature of existence that I think is in many ways very freeing. And so I began to sort of look at what I had previously seen as, like, horrible, you know, reconstructive work as a sort of different evidence of a completely different way of looking at history and the past, and not being too preoccupied with it, I guess. In the structural sense, right? In the artifact sense. Having said that, there is one group in Rangoon that's doing amazing restoration work, and you know, I'm glad that they exist too.
Perhaps they're not Theravada Buddhists.
Well, they're, you know, I think they're good Buddhists, but they also realize that there's some really beautiful parts of Burma that should be restored so people can see what the country was like, especially in Rangoon. Yeah.
Sometime in the early 60s, I had a Burmese roommate in college, and he had gotten out from the military takeover, but he characterized the population, like, his mother was Chinese, his mm-hmm. father was Burmese, and he said, you know, the Chinese really run stuff in Burma. the Indians are kind of shopkeepers, and the Burmese are like the laborers. And I don't know, I mean, that was his characterization, but if you had that, the people that are the Chinese now,
they really run Burma.
Okay.
Well, I mean, when Burma was languishing under a military dictatorship, the country that invested in Burma, the border China, was China. I mean, Mandalay is effectively a Chinese city. And Burma became a client state of China when it was sanctioned by most of the West, okay? So there's definite, I mean, I think that assessment from the 60s to some degree holds true today. Rangoon was definitely an Indian city. The Indians were in the engine room of the Burmese economy, which is a surprise why it's easy to sort of shame and marginalize those who were the laborers who also happen to have darker skin, like lessons we learn today. But also, I mean, you have to keep in mind that India and Burma under British rule were both known as India, right? Which the Burmese never really got over. And the Indians were seen by many Burmese as the patsies of the British. And the top officers and the top government magistrates who weren't British were Indian, which created tensions at both the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder and at the top of the socioeconomic ladder. So I don't think it's entirely fair to say that the Indians were just kind of like, you know, the shopkeepers, because they did hold some vaunted positions in government. But anyway, the fact is there are a lot of ethnic tensions exacerbated by economic, you know, inequality. And, you know, it's not something that's unique to Burma, all of this.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for being here. Please join me in thanking Alex Wagner for sharing her family
history
with us.
Thank you for coming out. Thank you for coming out.
And be sure to watch the circus.
And watch the circus. Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org.